The volume on that, is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. My name is Tony Bernhardt, and I'm a friend and a student of Sylvia's, and occasionally she asks me to fill in when she and Donald are off doing other things. And it's just a treat for me to be here. When Sylvia asked me to speak a little while ago, I thought, oh, okay, now what am I gonna talk about? So I started thinking. Well, you know, you start thinking. And weeks ago, and I thought, after mulling it over for a week or so, I thought, well, I'll talk about renunciation. That's a popular topic. And we all just go for renunciation. But then as we got closer, we got about a week and a half away, I became completely consumed by the situation in Iran. How many of you recognize the name Neda Soltan? She's the woman who was shot, and we've been seeing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I've been living on Twitter. How many of you are familiar with Twitter? How many of you use Twitter? Well, let me say a couple things about it because, you know, after not being able to sit down and think about renunciation anymore, I couldn't renounce Twitter, was sort of my problem. I thought, well, there's got to be some Dharma lessons in here. And of course, as soon as you start thinking, there certainly are. Twitter, young people know. In Iran, 2/3 of the population is under 33 years old. And there's a lot of skill with the internet there. It's a service. Let me see if I can describe it really quickly. It's a service where people can join and have an account, and you post little notes, and they can't be longer than 140 characters long. And people who are tracking you, following you, like my kids, you know, they are able to see what you're doing at any given moment because you post. And you can post from your computer or from cell phones. So you'd say something exciting like standing in line at the supermarket, and then they would know. So I joined, and after a week or so, I got bored. You know, my daughter would say, waiting for Malia at the dance class. I go, great, I needed that. But it allows you to have a collection of people who track you. And, of course, it can be used by, you know, political people who will, you know, people will track them. And they say things that are way more important. Testifying at a committee or complaining about this or that. But there are also these threads, these discussion threads that can get started on a topic. And anyone can post to them and anyone can read them. And I don't know how I stumbled on this. I guess because I was waiting for my granddaughter at a dance class. And there was Wi-Fi, and so I was doing the news stuff. It was a week ago. It was the day after the Iranian election. And I got referred to Twitter, and so I went and looked, and oh my gosh. On a couple of threads, one of them was just labeled Iran election, the little posts were coming so fast you couldn't read them. Dozens a second. I mean, you would refresh the screen and there'd be 200 new ones. You couldn't read them all. And they recounted in live time what was going on. So I printed out a bunch just to give you a sense of, you know, it's very difficult for these people to post because the government is tracking them down and arresting them for participating. They've closed the internet, but they couldn't close the internet for commercial reasons, but they were able to block Facebook and Twitter. But I think of them as kids, but they were able to work around it in huge numbers. So let me just read some of these so you get a flavor. If you've been glued to CNN, they weren't following anything at first because they had no reporters, no resources, nobody could report. One of my favorite posters is someone who identifies herself as Oxford Girl, and I think she's there. You can't really tell. You know. Tens of thousands of candles lit throughout Tehran, Mashhad, Shiraz, Ahwaz. Helicopters hovered overhead as about 200 protesters gathered at Haft-i-Tir Square, hundreds of riot police. They're hitting people in Haft-i-Tir Square. 3,000 to 5,000 people are there, a friend who just left there confirmed. Snipers installed on building tops in Seven-Tier Square. If you catch militia, do not use violence, do not kill him, treat him as your brother. If you advocate violence here, non-Iranian, you help Iranian authorities claim foreigners are to blame for the protests. If you have CB radio, only use when moving, never in fixed location, always off when near home base. Beware government agents spreading fear on Twitter. Only trust those who have a good record on Twitter. There are links. They can post a link to another website. And here's a link. Help for hiding your identity on the internet. Here's a link. Rafsanjani controls much of the army. Until now, he is silent. After trigger event, he will act. Iran also, one of us is badly injured and we cannot take to hospital, treating with trusted doctor, but needs hospital. We are having difficulty getting updates to you as many of our contacts have been arrested. Life here is very, very dangerous. If possible, buy CB radio for communication between groups, but be careful, use what while mobile. This is an interesting one. Queen Rania from Lebanon posts, the Iranian people have the virtues of a great civilization running through their veins. We love you, Iran. Alert, if you know any hackers, take down the Basij site. They have photos, they're looking for protesters, and a link to the site. Siemens and Nokia help Iranian government censor text messages. Never buying their shit again.
Mm-hmm. And
what?
Do they post them in English?
Most are in English, but there's some that are in Farsi, and Google created a translation site, so you can copy them, paste them in, and Tehran, 6 p.m., thousands are now in Haft-i-Tir Square, clashes after tear gas fired. General strike Tuesday. Warning on Islamic Guard website, they will crack down on protests, but many commanders privately say they will not. Tweets calling for violence, tweets are the name of a post to Twitter. Tweets calling for violence, most probably government spies, keep to principles of peaceful protest. Riot police attacking hundreds of protesters with tear gas and firing live bullets in the air. Unconfirmed, Rafsanjani has votes to remove Khamenei, needs secure support of army. Regime may attack Qom. Prophet Muhammad says signs of the hypocrite. When he speaks lies. When he is trusted, he betrays his trust. Do not be scared, we are all together. And it's just a flood. You know. And they link to other sites, mostly YouTube. So there's video. And some of these videos are just stunning because they'll show a picture of a crowd and everybody's got their cell phone up in the air. Everybody's recording everything. It's thousands of eyes. There was one that I found particularly striking. It was done intentionally. It wasn't done on a street. It had a series of people, Iranians, and they were holding up signs in Persian. So you couldn't read it at first, and then it came up with subtitles translated. And it was like, it reminded me of that, the opening of that first Bob Dylan movie where he stood and he, you know, and sorted the cards, you know, with the signs. So they would hold up a sign. And I thought, you know, okay, Mousavi is not, who's the alternative candidate. I mean, he's not a liberal by any means. He was the president of Iran in the 80s. He was part of the Islamic revolution in 79. But the spirit of freedom is just amazing. So this was one person after another, and it lasted about a minute and a half of video. And they would hold up a sign, and the signs read one after another. Defending civil rights, acting against poverty, reducing international tensions, free access to information, support single mothers, dealing a blow against violence against women, education for all, increasing public safety, rights for ethnic and religious minorities, public participation. We are asking for change. You know, even if the manifestation of that spirit is going to be continuation of an Islamic republic, even if the freedoms are not going to be expressed institutionally, the spirit is there. And we recognize that. But you know, we're left, here we are, and we're left with the media reports. We're left with Twitter or Facebook. We're left with CNN or NBC or whatever. We're left with the New York Times. And there's an odd disconnect that I've just been exploring for this past week particularly. You know, if we look at our lives, how we're living here, this is a wonderful spot in terms of the history of the planet. We have amenities that, boy, just didn't even exist for kings. Most of the history of the planet. If there ever were a heaven realm on this planet, we're living in the heaven realms. But we've got the soundtrack from hell. You know? And we suffer with that soundtrack. You know? It's painful. You know, when the president was asked if he'd seen the video of Neda dying, he said, yes, it was heartbreaking. And he paused, and then he repeated it again, heartbreaking. And we're left with that. And we encounter a huge portion of our experience is interpreted and presented that way. If you encounter a child who's crying, the response is automatic, right? I mean, are you okay? You pick it up. Isn't that, if someone, you know, is, well, the people in Iran, someone gets beaten on the street and everybody goes to help. It's just what we do. But if you see a picture of someone getting beaten on the street, if you see a picture of someone getting shot and dying, if you see a picture of a child crying, what can you do? And what are you left with? The Buddha talks about the our experience in terms of what he calls the sense bases. There are six of them. There are five senses that we are familiar with, and he includes the mind as the sixth. And he says we like pleasant experience, and we don't like unpleasant experience. And when pleasant experience comes along, we cling to it. We want it to last. When unpleasant experience comes along, we push it away. We don't want it to be, to continue. And that impulse to not be with things as they are, to make a change, to make it last or not last, is the heart of our suffering. We don't like things the way they are. It can be devastating. And we all can recall that from moments of our deeper grieving when the world isn't the way we want it to be. And the suffering that comes with that. Just not wanting it to be the way it is can make us sob in agony. The sixth sense base is the mind. And I think often that our problems aren't, I think of it this way, it's not the problems with the thermostat. It's not that it's too warm or too cold or too loud or too soft. Those things can be problems, but the problems that cause us the deepest suffering are related to the suffering in our mind, the mental sense base, the objects that arise, our understandings. The understandings in our mind. We like our opinions to be in accord with our, you know, we like opinions to be in accord with what makes us happy. We cling to our ideas about the way things are. You know, our opinions, the stories we tell, the stories which we use to identify what's going on, these fall under the aggregate of perception. What's going on? The mind labels, it identifies what's going on. It's an automatic function, the Buddha said. Nidha appears in the sixth sense base, in the sense base of the mind. And when we recall her and the way she died, it's sad. The sadness is very, very striking. How do we hold that? How do we hold the people who are complaining that the president isn't doing enough? He should be, you know, I think of John McCain singing Bomb Bomb Iran to the tune of Barbara Ann. Beach Boys would be rolling in there. But, and how do we react to that? You know, we have these things show up in our experience, in our mind, and we react. We anger, irritation, sadness. Disagreement is unpleasant. Right? We don't like disagreement. Anybody here love it? Just indulge in some disagreement here. Let's. Disagreement is unpleasant. The Buddha said, "There's no view, no idea, no thought, no story that is without suffering, because every view is subject to disagreement. Someone can disagree with almost anything, and no view is permanent." Joe and I were talking this morning about maybe we weren't. Maybe we weren't. We were talking this morning. And now I'm wondering whether we were talking about Galileo. No. Yes? No, okay. So it was just a fantasy of mine. See? You know, about how we think back, how quaint it was for people to think that the sun went around the earth.
Oh, yes, we were.
Oh, yes! And now we think of that as terribly primitive, because we know the earth goes around the sun, but who knows what new reformulation of cosmology is going to, you know, happen, and they say, well, they used to think the earth went around the sun, but we know it's just some gravity trap and a warp of space-time. I don't know. Of course I don't know. If I knew, you know. But we cling to our ideas of how things are, and we hardly know anything. You know, 90% of the universe is dark matter. We know it's there. Oh, we don't know it's there. People who measure this stuff know it's there, but they don't know what it is, but they know it's, 90% of material existence, we don't know, even have a clue about, except that it's sort of there. We have views about it. How old is the universe? 18 billion? 7,000? Well, we can laugh about 7,000. We can laugh about 18 billion. You know, the Buddha talked about, you know, hundreds of mahakalpas. So, you know how long a mahakalpa is? I love this one. This is how long it took the Buddha to perfect himself. One mahakalpa is, you have a mountain the size of Everest, and every 100 years a little bird flies by with a silk handkerchief in its beak and it brushes across the top of the mountain. When that mountain is worn down, that's one mahakalpa. You know, do we have, we, you know, that's and there was 100 of them. So we can relax if we're not moving along at a pace that, you know, our own evolution is slow. But we you know, our view of things, and of course, you know, have you ever gotten into an argument over whether the universe is 7,000 years old or 17 billion years old? You know, this poor cashier at my supermarket. You know. So, you know, how do we hold these views in a way that do not? And I was telling Joe, you know, you know, after that encounter with that poor cashier, the people in my sitting group heard about it for months because I was really upset. You know, God, I grew up with an astronomer for a father, so, you know, I knew it wasn't 7,000 years, but maybe it is. Who knows? You know. So how do we hold these views in a way that's skillful? Renunciation. You know, how do we hold them? We have ideas about the Iranian people. Last Friday night, the night before Neda was shot, everybody was, the tweets were full of quotes from the prophet. And they were things like, They were complaining about the Basij because they were coming into these quotes from Muhammad, don't enter a house without being invited. And these people were breaking, you know. What happens when we see injustice? We recognize injustice. You know, we react with aversion, anger. Based on our clinging to some idea of how things should be. I was in a conversation over the weekend with some people, and everybody was very upset about this and that. And one of the things people were upset about was the $1.5 billion that was just approved for the military budget. And I realized that that didn't bother me. And I thought, gee, I need to work up some aversion for this. But then I thought, well, you know, really, whether I have anger about that or not, it doesn't change the fact that it's happened. You ever heard the description of resentment as drinking poison and hoping the other person gets sick? You know? So no matter how much anger I have or irritation or whatever about the military budget, it doesn't change anything except it leaves me upset. And then I carry that upset around and pass it on. So when we live with this soundtrack from hell and we suffer from it, we experience all of the unpleasantness that comes with that. We carry that around. And we pass it on. There's a lot of, well, Donald Rothberg, who sits in for Sylvia, who shares the group with Sylvia, very committed to engaged practice. And engaged practice, you know, somebody said, you know, if you're a Buddhist, you're engaged. you can't avoid it. But if the response, if the engagement is coming out of anger, it's very different than if it's coming out of compassion. So when we see the story about Nada, we can respond with sadness. We can respond with anger. When we are aware of a situation where someone is harming another, we can respond with anger towards the oppressor, or we can respond with compassion for the victim. Those are the normal responses, right? And if we act out of anger, it's very different. It's going to be a very different action. The karma will be very different. The results will be very different than if we act out of compassion. But the trick, from the Buddhist standpoint, would be to respond compassionately to the basiji. To the oppressors, to the people who are... Oh, you know, I should have brought Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, Call Me By My True Names. Some of you will know it. If any of you happen to have it sitting handy in a notebook, I'd read it. But he talks about how he, you know, I am the sea pirate, and I'm the girl who throws herself into the ocean after having been raped by the sea pirate. You know, the compassion for the person suffering is obscured by our own anger. How do you hold Rush Limbaugh? You don't have to really hold him.
Thank you.
But you know what I mean. You know, are we able to even see him through our own irritation and anger? You know, if the first noble truth is that suffering comes with the territory, all beings are experiencing that dissatisfaction. And so we cling to our opinions, our views, which are subject to, well, they're subject to disagreement. And do we see past them? It's difficult because of our ideas about how things are. How do we maintain mindfulness of our own thoughts without being caught up in the thoughts? Because most of our disputes are over abstract thinking, the way we think things ought to be. Somebody else doesn't think that. You know, we get into disagreements. There's that line from the early Dylan song, abstract threats too noble to neglect deceived me into thinking I had something to protect. And so we don't see, so we respond with anger, compassion for the victim. You know, we side with the prey in the, don't we? In, you know, between predator and prey, we side with the prey. You know, we'll save, but there's a story about the Buddha in one of his prior incarnations during the Mahakalpas while he was perfecting his personal qualities, where, you know, he was addressed by a bird of prey and said, well, how am I going to survive? And the Buddha's response was to say, well, take my own flesh. Rather than that of the rabbit or whatever it was. So we just, it's not that it's wrong or right, just to notice how we side with the victim and we don't side with the oppressor. And yet the oppressor is also subject to the same suffering, the same dissatisfaction that we are. And it's not that we should do this or should do that. Just notice how we have, you know, how our response is different to the Iranian government, to Ahmadinejad, to the Basiji. The Basiji, most of them, you know who they are? These are the militias. It's not the government people. These are sort of like the militias we got here. Most of them, a large proportion of them, were involved in the Iran-Iraq War. You know, they were soldiers at one time. And, you know, suffered that and have left with the damage that experience would create. So we also don't normally think of regarding our own experience with compassion. The suffering and sadness, you know, Jack Kornfield calls NPR the Dukkha Channel. Yeah, just tune in. Yeah. The soundtrack from hell, it's amazing. And it colors the way we see the world and the way we live, even though life on this planet has hardly been better anywhere. Just materially, physically. If we eliminated all of the injustice on the planet, all of the social injustice, that wouldn't put an end to samsara, to dukkha. Our individual suffering would be still there. Our dissatisfaction with our own impermanence. Boy, we don't like that. Buddha said it's not possible to find satisfaction in this life. Relief, occasionally. It's like the weather. There are occasionally beautiful days. And then there are times of storm, and there's a lot of, you know, sort of the way the weather usually is. But it's not possible to set it up so that the sun is shining. Is that Mose Allison song? If you live, the time will come when the sun will shine and the crops will grow and you think that you're not going to worry no more, but if you live, your time will come. It's built in. We don't like that either. I don't think. It's not just me, right? So we should hold ourselves with compassion as well. And our own, you know, we're subject to and exposed to this. You know, and the media is like the astronomers who, it's 90% of the universe that they don't even know what it is. And the media present its perspective, and we can be angry because they don't present it our way, and there are a lot of people who are. Hey, I should talk more about this, and they shouldn't cover that guy, and that's the way it is. You know, it's like complaining about the weather. It's just the way it is. Holding this is really tricky. One of the things the president said, I have to say, I just am such a fan of our president. You know, which is, it's really unusual for me, just in the course of my life. This hasn't happened before, so I'm having to learn a whole new relationship to him. So he was speaking last week. First time he spoke about the situation in Iran. And he quoted Martin Luther King. He said, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's just wonderful. Is he talking about intelligent design here? You know, I asked Steve Armstrong, who's a Dharma teacher, a senior teacher at IMS and lives in Hawaii, was doing a talk on free will and the universe. And at one point, I went up to him afterwards. I said, "My gosh, what you're saying is this is all on automatic pilot. So the impulse to awaken, that has to be built in. Are you talking about intelligent design?" And without dropping a beat, he said, "Yes, thank God." Is the moral arc of the universe bent toward justice? You know, and is it skillful to think that it might be, or unskillful? Right view, remember the first two elements of the Eightfold Path, right view and right intention, they're linked because your intentions are formed in terms of your understanding of the way things are. If you think one person is hurting another, you may rush to this person to help them, and maybe that's not what's going on. You know, our house sits right next to a park. A little park, a neighborhood park. And yesterday I was sitting and reading and I heard a child screaming, just screaming. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I got up and went in because something's going on. I went out, well, yeah, he was screaming, he was throwing a fit. You know, it was very cute once I saw what was going on. But my initial take wasn't necessarily right. But I acted on that understanding. Crying could be, and you act on your understanding. And if your understanding is diluted, well then, you're likely to act out in ways that are not helpful, that will enhance suffering, enhance dissatisfaction, and not attenuate it. And really skillful action is about attenuating suffering rather than enhancing it. So is the moral arc of the universe, does it bend towards justice? You know, if you think that, you're likely to behave or respond or hold the events that arise in experience differently than if you think that it's, that the universe is indifferent, uncaring. So what's skillful, what's not? It's hard to know. Any one of these tweets, you know, CNN, if you watch CNN, CNN says, well, they've... I'm thinking, well, CNN is now reading Twitter to those of us who can't manage the computer. CNN, reading Twitter to older folks since 2009. That's going to be their new slogan. But they make their disclaimers all over the place. You know, we don't know whether this is true. It's somebody, we don't know who they are. You know, unconfirmed. You know, that's constantly, they're reporting it, but they're, you know, after you see thousands of them, it's a different experience. But any one of them, how do you hold any one of these? Well, you sort of recognize it, you know, and we react to it. It's a thought. It's like a thought in our mind. We react to it. But, you know, we can hold it tentatively. We can say, well, we don't know. There was Zen master Sung San, who was the founder of the Cambridge Zen Center, a Korean Zen master, used to urge his students to cultivate don't know mind. Don't know. At the deepest level, don't know. Everything we think we know sets us up for suffering. So it's not that we say this isn't true. It's that we hold it, well, maybe provisionally, or at least recognize that it's a thought. When we sit, you know, our eyes closed, the thoughts come, and we react to them. The repeating thought comes, da-da-da-da-da-da, and we go, oh my gosh, anger, look at this. You can get worked up while you're sitting there with your eyes closed. Or you can collapse in sadness, or you can become terrified. Everything can happen while you're sitting. And it happens while you're not sitting, too. The Buddha had a word for the kind of mental proliferation that goes on when one thought leads to another, papancha. Just the bubble machine. You know, turn off the bubble machine. The media is the same. You know, things show up, we get reactive. And it's not so much that we shouldn't, it's just that we should be aware of how we react. And how, you know, how that leaves us. It's not that we should turn off the radio. My gosh, I used to have a practice that Sylvia talks about often, where I used to listen to talk radio, Rush Limbaugh particularly, and Michael Savage, just because it was so hard to do. And my goal was to make, when I was growing up, Sunday morning, the whole short end of the radio, AM radio spectrum, was preachers. And I used to go through the dial, and they were all boring. So I was looking for something interesting. And my goal was for Rush and Michael Savage and all this to be about as boring to me, as mundane as those preachers. Because we get reactive, and it's not that we shouldn't. We just need to pay attention to how we respond. We don't want to be sad. We don't want to feel pain. And so one of the ways we react when that comes up is with anger. We cover that anger with, or cover that pain, that sadness, with anger. Compassion is difficult when there isn't a being present when it's just a story or a picture. You know, it's different if you've got a crying baby in front of you and if you've got, you know, the Save the Children ad. And of course, that's a setup, you know, the crying baby, and when the response comes, they want you to make the phone call or whatever. So it's intentionally done. But just to notice the difference between our response to our immediate environment and to the messages we get about it. Because we suffer from this soundtrack. And the skillful intentions, the Buddha said, are generosity, loving kindness, and compassion. And the unskillful intentions are greed, ill will, and cruelty. We pretty much rule ourselves out on the cruelty one, but maybe not. If the idea here is to intentionally cause pain, and when we say, you don't get the car in by 10 o'clock on Saturday, you know, you won't be driving it for a month. You know, we're using the stick, threatening the stick, brandishing it anyway. I think that's how I understand cruelty. Not just going out on the motorbike in your black uniform and beating people, or your camouflage pajamas. Whatever uniform you like. So I just notice how, you know, my reaction to the media displays of what's going on, it brings you the information, but it leaves you without, it's not an interactive thing. And so the interaction happens in our mind. And so being mindful of our thinking, very tough. It's very hard to do. Because when you sit and you start getting lost in thought, you got to back off a little bit in order to see it as thought. You know, to stay with the breath and watch the thinking going on. Usually you just right into the thought stream. Or that's not just me, right? Just want to check because I've been doing this for a while and it seems, you know, but slowly you get, you know, you become aware of your thinking and of the suffering that thinking engenders. Is this our? We live in the media. You know, much of the world comes to us through the media and leaves us without an interactive response, which occurs in our mind. We just need to study it. So let me just check in with you guys about this, and if you follow Iran, have similar. I noticed that someone was brought the people of Iran into the group at the end. I was going to speak to that as well. Please.
I think for me, my hope is with the young people.
Mm-hmm.
I see that in our country as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that young people seem to be looking at the world with a different lens, with a lens of inclusiveness,
mm-hmm.
and a lens of compassion and a great feeling about what's going on in the world.
And that kind of, you know, holding that idea is buoyant. We like hope and we don't like fear. And both hope and fear are about our image of what's about to come. And if we focus on that attitude of youth, it's inspiring. I sent Twitter messages to a couple of the people who were posting from Tehran, and they both responded. Well, two of the three responded. I just said, you are just such an inspiration to me. And one woman wrote back and just said, freedom. Mm. You know, it's uplifting. Yeah.
I think there is a real feeling of disconnect, and that can leave us feeling helpless, among other things, angry. And we always have the ability to act in a way that can promote peace or justice. I mean, we can support Amnesty International, or we can do volunteer work, try to make peace within our family. I mean, I think as long as we leave it in this abstract realm, there is no progress. But I mean, I think that there are things that every day we can do to promote peace or justice.
We certainly can. We certainly can.
I think that that diminishes that kind of helplessness and the fear and the anger and the rage, or, you know, like all that stuff that can build up
sure.
in the space of inaction.
Well, you know, I always think, first of all, I think Amnesty International, you know, in some ways it's abstract as well. I mean, they may be there. You know,
that's just an example.
It's not that there's anything wrong with this abstract thing. It's just that we should notice how we're responding. And we certainly can support Amnesty, and we don't send money to Ahmadinejad, you know. Right? Just checking. You know, but yes, absolutely. In fact, that action that is motivated out of compassion and kindness generates more.
We don't have to go all the way to Iran.
No, we don't. In fact, we aren't gonna. You know. So much of this is not interactive. New York Times is not interactive. Now, I could send a little note to these people in Tehran and say, you know, take care of yourself on the street. It sounds dangerous. Can't do that with here. And even just a little note is, I mean, it's something, but it's not the relationship, the direct relationship with someone who's sitting right in front of you, who you live with, who you encounter on the street.
And I think that, like, a lot of us are so involved in TV and movies and the media that we're not asking our neighbors if they're okay,
I think that's true. We live in our thoughts. We live in the stories, you know, and we live in the stories. And when I encounter that checker, I've got a story about her, and you know, I'm still working with her. But we're all working with, you know, the Rush Limbaughs of the world. And not that she's a Rush Limbaugh, but with the people who are difficult for us. We all have difficult people. And knowing, you know, recognizing that someone's difficult and knowing that we've got work to do, you know, if we don't feel compassion for those people, then we know we've got work to do because they're suffering like we are. Please. Did you have your hand up there?
Mm-hmm. I'm debating whether I should say it or not.
Oh.
Because I'm listening to all this. Well, my history goes back because I got married in 1978 and moved to France. And so the Iranian siege was during that time, and I felt very isolated in America, and we didn't have Twitter or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
The history of Iran and what happened between 1978 and today is very prominent in my mind because I lived with a lot of Iranian people who were displaced and came over to England, where I lived for 16 years in France, and they were homeless, and it was sad. So I hold that always, but what I'm thinking of is that we are bombarded so much by the media, and I am so compassionate by the whole change of the world today, that when more comes, I am deeply bothered by this, especially when you see a young woman who's over and over again. How many times does one have to see it over and over again? I feel that even giving lip service over and over again is not productive to me, because I have the weight of everything here on my shoulders always, and just to add another thing, I want to ingest it and feel and then let it go, because I'm not trying to criticize you for bringing this up, but we have so much going on in the world today. It's hard for me to say this. It sounds so cold-hearted, but sometimes I feel that we have to hold it and then let it go. There's so much going on for us right here, and we're all experiencing it. And I do feel that we've become a much more compassionate nation, and we are more in touch with other people, and we aren't so enclosed. Maybe it's just my personal experience. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that we're not in touch with others. I mean, this community very much is.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm struggling with the idea of holding these images of this woman and holding this image of this and bringing it home to me is much more important, mm-hmm, right here where I am. So maybe I'm having a little trouble being compassionate.
You know,
what is
occurring to me as I'm hearing you speak is just the opening lines from The Tale of Two Cities. It's the best of times and it's the worst of times. We can find it all, you know, depending on what we look for. And how we hold it. We need to let go of both the pleasant as well as the unpleasant, because the pleasant is going to change and the unpleasant is going to come. And we have to be present with whatever presents itself. Otherwise, we suffer. One more and then.
Well, I've been having this kind of running conflict kind of along the lines of what we've been talking about here. Do I listen to Amy Goodman, or do I not listen to Amy Goodman? I listen to Amy Goodman, and I'm just so impressed with the depth of thing, you know, the depth they get into about a lot of issues, and I learn a lot. And I listen to her for a few weeks, and then suddenly I am so depressed I can hardly stand it. I mean, I just feel like the world's gone to hell and I can't bear it, so I quit. And I don't listen for a long time now. So I guess I've noticed that, but I just thought, well, you're kind of a wuss, I guess, but you're tuning out. But I guess maybe I'm just, as you're phrasing it, having trouble holding all that negativity, and I don't think it's good for me internally because I'm not working with it in a productive way.
It's difficult, and there's no should or shouldn't. There's not like, you know, two measures of Amy Goodman, one measure of our president. You know, I mean, there's no algorithm here for happiness. It's something we navigate. You know, we have to use our heart and our mind. And we are as aware as we can be and responsive as we can be.
But that awareness sometimes just kind of pushes you over the top.
Well, and you can get pushed over the top and be unaware at the same time. and then you say, how did I get here? Well, thank you all for your attention. And
thank you.
I hope to see you again soon.